podcast is provided by World Harvest International and Gourmet Foods at 6th and University in Champaign. For over 14 years, providing Champaign-Urbana with an international selection of cheeses, olive oil, balsamic vinegar, spices, chocolates, cookies, and more. Catering services are also available. World Harvest encourages you to join them in supporting public radio. Support for today's broadcast comes from the Yoga Institute of Champaign-Urbana, offering beginner-level instruction in Iyengar Yoga and special classes for men, women, teens, seniors, healthy heart, plus size, knees, low back, neck, and shoulders. New classes start after Labor Day. Information at 344-YOGA or on the web at yoga-cu.com.
Have you entered the WILL sweepstakes? You could win one of 10 major prizes for your home, each worth $1,000 or more. But time's running out. Your entry must be postmarked by September 6th to win the high-definition TV, the computer, or area rug. If you need an entry form, call WILL at 217-333-0850.
Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Back in the late 1980s, Yucca Mountain in Nevada was picked to be the site for permanent storage of America's high-level radioactive waste. It has been a long and torturous road, and now the Department of Energy expects that site will be ready to accept waste in 2010, although all along the project has faced widespread opposition, both from people in Nevada and from some scientists who are concerned about whether or not indeed this site is technically suitable for storing high-level waste. This morning, we thought we would take an hour and get caught up on recent developments in this story. And our guest for the program is Dr. Arjun Mukhijani. He's president and senior engineer at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research, based in Tacoma Park, Maryland. And he is someone who, throughout the years, has been interested in both the technical and environmental issues associated with energy generation and also nuclear weapons production. We last spoke with him about this subject in the winter of 2002, and there have been some new developments, and so we thought it would be a good idea to get caught up. Just a little bit more about him. He is principal editor and co-author of The First Global Assessment of the Health and Environmental Effects of Nuclear Weapons Production. This was a book that was titled Nuclear Wastelands. It was published in 1995. Of course, he's done other writing and research. He's also been a consultant to a number of organizations, including the Tennessee Valley Authority, Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory, and various programs of the United Nations. He's joining us this morning by telephone, and as we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. If it would be a long-distance call for you, you're listening around Illinois, Indiana, or even if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you can use the toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So 333-WILL or 9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Dr. Mukhijani, hello.
Hello, David. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Good to talk to you again.
Well, we appreciate very much you giving us some of your time.
No problem.
This is, as I mentioned, has been a very long process. It began in the early 80s when the Department of Energy was directed by Congress to develop a list of possible sites. And they started with 9, then they narrowed it to 3. Those were approved by Ronald Reagan, who was president at the time. And then in 1987, Congress told the Department of Energy to concentrate on just one of those sites, and that was Yucca Mountain. We probably could talk about just that for a while, but I guess as a way of starting out, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about why is it that after looking at a number of possible sites for the high-level storage site, after a few years, the Congress and the folks there in Washington focused on one place to the exclusion of any place else, and that was Yucca Mountain.
Well, David, I think there's one part of the law that even you have forgotten, even though you follow these issues quite closely, which is in the original legislation in 1982, Congress had asked that two different repository sites should be investigated. One in the West, and 9 sites were named, and then there would be another repository site in the East, but no sites were named in the law. The Department of Energy was to publish a list of possible sites it would investigate in the East later on. It did that in January in 1986. And there were sites in Maine and New Hampshire and many other eastern seaboard states which are populated with rich and influential people. New Hampshire also happens to be politically very important, and Bush won. President Bush, number 41, was at the time vice president, and he was hoping to run for president, and New Hampshire, of course, is very important to anybody with such hopes. Well, the people of New Hampshire and the Northeast knew that, and so they went. They secured an appointment with Vice President Bush's chief of staff in the White House. They went to see him in, I think, May or June of 1986, and mysteriously, 2 weeks later, the entire Eastern Repository Program was canceled. And it was, I believe, a very political thing that happened. It's never been established exactly what the White House role might have been, if any, but one can. I think the circumstantial evidence is strong. After that, the whole program was thrown into a terrible crisis, and the Department of Energy and many others sort of lobbied for one site to be named to put the miseries of democracy behind them. They could just do it by fiat. So what people in Nevada call the Screw Nevada Bill was therefore passed in 1987. Everybody said, well, it's a very dry desert site. There's nobody over there. What harm could there be from taking high-level nuclear waste there and burying it? After all, it's just a desert.
And of course, and we can get into this as we talk about more current developments. Ever since, people in Nevada, including their congressional members of their congressional delegation and their two senators, one of them is a Republican, one of them is a Democrat, have been fighting this. And the most recent development in this was the fact that the state of Nevada took the country to court and said, "No, this process by which you selected us as the host for the site was unconstitutional." Now, they didn't prevail on that count, but there was something else that was interesting that at least some people say casts the future of the site in some doubt. But we'll get to that. We'll tease people with that, and maybe we'll manage to hold on to their attention here over the next little bit.
technical topic.
Well, and also in case people have any doubt about the material that we are talking about, maybe also I should give you the chance to talk a little bit about what this stuff is and where it comes from, the waste that would be stored there.
Yes. Most of the waste that would be put in a deep geologic repository, which currently is slated to be Yucca Mountain, is waste from nuclear power plants. You have quite a lot of them in Illinois. It's maybe the state that is most dependent on nuclear power in the United States. And nuclear power plants use uranium fuel that becomes highly radioactive when uranium is fissioned. And fission products emit intense radiation. They build up. More than 95% of all the radioactivity in the United States waste is in the spent fuel, the used-up fuel from nuclear power plants, which is currently stored at the power plant sites, mostly in very large pools where it is kept cool, and to some extent in dry casks that are also stored on site.
The site that we're talking about, as for people to visualize it, and I guess as I think about it, essentially what we're talking about are large artificial caves that are located far below the surface in volcanic rock. So what you'd be doing is essentially digging down and then tunneling out these large chambers where the fuel rods, eventually stored in these protective casks, will be laid out, and then they'll sit there, theoretically, until they are no longer radioactive. Is that basically it?
Well, they'll never be no longer radioactive because they contain uranium. Mostly 94% of the waste is uranium-238, which has a half-life as long as the Earth itself, 4 billion years. So it'll never be not radioactive, but its radioactivity will decline to levels where water resources won't be critically threatened maybe in a few hundred thousand or a few million years. So we're talking about essentially digging out a mine, but instead of taking something out of the mine like a resource, we're talking about putting waste in the mine. And this waste is very dangerous, and it has to be kept isolated, especially from the water, because if the fission products of plutonium or americium reach the water, it will be impossible to undo the pollution.
Pardon me for interrupting you. I was just going to go on and say and point to the fact that, that indeed that seems to be the main concern, that is that water could percolate through the soil and find ways through the rocks and get into the storage site. And if there was any sort of leakage or water could get at the material that's stored there, that eventually it could end up in the groundwater.
Yep.
And that would be a problem for those people in living in the area that, that depend on that for their water supply.
Yeah, that's right. Now, it's not a question of if water will go down into the repository level. Water will go down. Rain, snow, and so on occurs even in desert environments, and the rate of percolation has been found to be pretty high, actually, in Nevada. The rock over there, which is called volcanic tuff, is quite porous. And so the water finds its way down relatively rapidly to the repository level. And the big question is, what is going to happen once this water comes into contact with these huge metal containers in which the waste will be packaged? And because water and oxygen, which is in the pores of the rock, and the heat, which is in the spent fuel, are a combination that produces or tends to produce corrosion, the fear is that the canisters will be corroded away, laying the waste bare, and thereby enabling its contact with water supplies.
So there really are a number of issues here. One has to do with the geology of the site and how that behaves, but the other has to do with the integrity of the storage medium that's used for the material.
Yeah, David, originally when the rules were made for repositories in the 80s, the geologic site was supposed to be chosen so that the type of rock would essentially absorb or adsorb the radionuclides. Hmm. That means that the radioactive particles from the waste, if they escaped from the containers, which were expected to deteriorate, would stick to the surfaces of the rock. And so they would not, even when the water percolated down and mobilized the waste, it would stick to the rock and not make it to the groundwater or usable water supplies. It turns out that Yucca Mountain is actually a very poor site by this criterion. And the rock is essentially useless from the point of view of holding on to the waste. So the whole burden of containment is essentially on canister system and the engineered barriers around the, like the backfill that is put around the canisters. And actually, Yucca Mountain geology is so poor that it could not have met the original rules for geologic repositories that were created. And so new rules have been created just to accommodate Yucca Mountain. And the whole thing is now dependent on how you run a computer program, not how the system will perform in actual practice.
Well, I know that there are some people who would make the argument that while the site might not be perfect, it is possible that we might yet be able to use it. And also they acknowledge the fact that we do have a serious issue here of what we're going to do with the high-level waste that's now being stored at, and as you said, mostly what we're talking about is material that is the result of electric power generation. So it's being stored at the power plants where it was produced. The utility companies want to get it off their hands. It's dangerous for them. It's expensive. There's a security issue. So they want to get it out of storage. And there certainly must be, there will come a time when they simply won't be able to do that anymore. So I guess I'm wondering, is it your feeling that we can work with Yucca Mountain or that, in fact, it's simply not suitable and that even though we spent a lot of time and a lot of money, that we have to start looking for someplace else?
Well, I am a critic of Yucca Mountain and a supporter of geologic repositories. We have to do a scientific process with integrity of finding a site that's suitable. Yucca Mountain, in my opinion, is the worst single repository site that has been investigated in the United States. The rules that the government itself set have been changed at least three times to accommodate Yucca Mountain, because Yucca Mountain simply could not meet. I've told you about the NRC rules. The Environmental Protection Agency rules were also changed twice to accommodate Yucca Mountain. The drinking water standards have been relaxed in that drinking water standards around Yucca Mountain will not apply in the future on federal land. So lots of loopholes have been created, and still Yucca Mountain cannot protect public health in the far future. People say, well, you know, it's a desert. There's nobody out there. 200 years ago, you could have gone to where Las Vegas is today and said the same thing. The fact is that there are animals grazing within 10 miles of Yucca Mountain and major agriculture within 20 miles of Yucca Mountain, which uses water from the aquifer that is under Yucca Mountain. This is happening today. So I do empathize with the utilities. I think they have misplaced their trust in the Department of Energy. I have long felt that the Department of Energy is a major generator of waste, should not be in charge of a repository program. You keep saying we've been looking for a long time and been working on this for a long time, but just think 25 years or 24 years is just 0.1% of the half-life of plutonium. We need to take a little bit of time to do this right. The utilities have been paying the government into a nuclear waste fund. The government's been spending off the money for our general revenue purposes. And also the Department of Energy, I think, has misspent a lot of the money on a hopeless site. So it's time to actually move on and not throw good money after bad and to create a process that won't be so politicized. You know, Nevada was a very weak state politically when it was named, and now its fortunes have turned, and now it happens to be a state that might decide the presidential election by itself in the next. And so many other issues ride on whether the people of Nevada think that Yucca Mountain is an important enough issue to decide their vote. So you see a different type of tussle that has evolved over the last 20 years. And this is not the way to find a sound repository.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Dr. Arjun Makhijani, he's president and senior engineer of the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research in Tacoma Park, Maryland. And this is an issue that certainly he has been following for a long time. As I said, beginning, he's particularly interested in technical, environmental, and perhaps also social issues associated with both energy generation and also another major area of interest of his, and that is the problems associated with the production of nuclear weapons. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455, and we have several people here lined up and ready to go. Starting with Indiana, a caller in Bloomington, Indiana, on our toll free line, line 4. Hello.
Hi. About the danger of polluting water, I know that if the radioactive material actually gets into the water, makes the water dangerous. But if the water is simply heated by circulating it around the radioactive waste, that water is just hot. And now I know there isn't enough heat yield in those spent nuclear rods to generate electricity anymore. But couldn't you make a virtue out of necessity? I mean, you have a source of warm water, if not still hot water, and you could make a health spa. You could do a lot of things to make a virtue. See, the people of Nevada, I understand they don't want all those spent rods. They think they're dangerous. But by making a virtue out of necessity, giving them a resource of hot water that they can use as a health spa, might not they decide that maybe they like nuclear wastes?
You know, that Actually, health spas of radioactive and radioactive environments were promoted early in the last century quite a bit when there was more fascination with radioactivity as a health benefit. But it turned out not to be quite so. It's very difficult to keep the radioactivity in the canisters. That is the problem that I've been illustrating, because contact of these canisters with water tend to corrode them. For instance, these spent fuel rods are stored underwater currently, and the water gets hot. But unfortunately, the water also gets radioactive, and it's not very sensible from a health point of view to put people in contact with it. And the amount of heat that's generated after they've been sitting around for a few years is really not worth very much. It's dangerous enough to pose corrosion risks, but it's not attractive enough economically to go after the heat.
Well, now, can you suggest, if Yucca Mountain is not an acceptable site, could you suggest a better site?
Well, I've actually written, you know, I don't believe in being a naysayer. If I think that there is, that we should have a repository, I feel that as a scientist and engineer, I should put forward a plan. And we've done that. You can go to our website, ieer.org, and see that. I think we should take about 10 years to focus, or 15 years, to focus on some very basic science and geology. And here's what I mean by that. If you look at Mother Nature, you'll find there are lots of places where there are special naturally occurring materials that have traces of radioactivity that are simply locked up there for millions of years. They tend to be specific to particular geologic environments, and so what I believe we have to do is to find those environments and learn how to engineer materials like that and test them. Different materials will work in different environments, and so we can make these engineered analogs of natural materials. Secondly, we've done a lot of radioactive pollution undersea, on land, and in various places, deep and shallow, and I think very careful research on radioactivity migration, some of which has actually begun within the nuclear weapons establishment in the last 10 years or so, should be continued. And at the end of 10 or 15 years, I think we'll have a pretty good idea about how to select a site properly, what the criteria should be, how it should be married to the right kind of containers that won't corrode but rather last a very long time, and how we can engineer these materials. So I think the rush to find a site and put it somewhere is really itself driven by, you know, the rush of nuclear power plant operators to get rid of this waste. I don't blame them, as I said. They're paying into the government fund, and the government's been wasting the money. So we need to kind of get back to the table and start this again properly.
Thank you very much.
All right, sure. Thanks for the call. That's just to carry that point on just further for just a moment, one of the things that, as you say, adds some urgency, or at least as far as the federal government is concerned, might add some urgency, is the fact that now I believe more than 60 nuclear power companies have filed suit against the government trying to recover their costs of dealing with this waste. And what they have done is they've said you, federal government, you took ownership of the waste. You told us that that you would begin taking this 10, 12 years ago.
And yeah, 1998.
Yeah, 1998. And you still haven't done it. This is costing us a lot of money to deal with it. So you ought to actually pay us back. And I think that there already has been, I think Exelon managed to get a judgment, and then there are others, and it looks like if all of these other power companies prevail in that argument, ultimately, we could be talking about an enormous amount of money that would have to be paid to these utilities to help them with the cost of dealing with this stuff on site.
Yeah, David, it's going to be billions of dollars. And in this regard, you know, I think the utilities are right, because the government is frittering away the money that ratepayers of utilities are paying to the government. So it's like as if, you know, you paid a gasoline tax for transportation and highways and rail and so on, and then it got it got spent on a solar energy system someplace. Well, you might like a solar energy system, but that's not what the money was originally designated for. So I think, you know, the lawsuits may relieve a financial problem for the utilities, and I think that they are right to sue the government because the government did default on its contract. But it is not going to solve the problem of nuclear waste that they have on site so long as the government doesn't have any place to put it. And moreover, we've got the problem of terrorism that is also serious, and the utilities need to attend to that better than they're doing. I certainly don't mind, if there is some combination of public and ratepayer resources and utility resources that goes into making these things more secure. But I think we should look to on-site storage for a few decades and hunker down and make it safer and also have a better repository program.
Let's talk with someone else. The next caller up is in Herrick, Illinois, and that's line number two. Hello.
Hi. It seems to me like maybe the criteria is all messed up. It seems like the idea is to put it off in a place where nobody's going to ever see it again. And to me, it seems like it would be much better if we were to locate it in the middle of a major metropolis, downtown Chicago, downtown L.A., downtown New York City. It would, A, remind all them city people that they're using this power, and B, I bet they'd keep an eye on it like a hawk.
Well, you know, what you're saying is not entirely a frivolous issue. The issue of human intrusion, both deliberate or inadvertent, is one of the big unresolved issues. I'm not a fan of nuclear repositories. I only reluctantly recommend them because we cannot leave nuclear waste lying around at 60 sites around the country forever. But I also think that we ought to phase out nuclear power and stop producing this stuff. We can't shut down the power plants overnight, but we can phase them out over a 20, 30-year period, and we've actually published a plan like that. Now, the plan that you propose, I actually, just as a conceptual challenge, gave exactly such a suggestion, not seriously, but as a conceptual challenge to the National Research Council of the National Academy of Sciences. I think it was 2 years ago or 3 years ago. And I challenged them that they have not really seriously thought about this problem of human intrusion. And, you know, at the end of my talk, they had absolutely nothing to say about this.
Well, I don't mean this suggestion frivolously.
No, I know you don't.
It just seems to me, now, this is going to be a major item of danger for a long time.
Yes.
And it seems like the more eyes that keep track of it, the better. And I know, you know, let's face it, the reason we're putting it out in the desert is so that nobody will keep an eye on it.
Well,
if it was in the middle of a major metropolis, not only would there be a lot of people keeping an eye on it, it would eventually become a big incentive to actually do something to neutralize it in a permanent fashion, where if we put it out in Yucca Mountain, it's going to be forgotten about after, you know, let's face it, after a couple of millennia, it's not too likely that we're going to remember it.
Couple of millennia is too long. I think we'll forget about it much faster. cities are no guarantee of memory. I'll give you an example. This is a tougher problem than you present. In World War One, the army was in the far suburbs of Washington, not suburbs, the far areas of Washington D.C. inside the city, but that were undeveloped in fancy Massachusetts Avenue. They developed and tested chemical weapons there, and then they buried a whole bunch of chemical weapons and wastes in the environs of what is now American University, and then forgot about it. Then very fancy houses, developments, and so on, expansion of American University happened in that area. It's one of the most expensive areas of Washington, just northwest of Embassy Row, and chemical weapons were discovered in people's backyards in the 1980s, and then the government covered it up. and and did not want to recover the institutional memory. As a result, the whole thing is a terrible health, environmental, political, and financial mess, because right in the middle of the capital of the country, they forgot they buried chemical weapons there within 3-4 decades.
Oh, you're right. It would have to be a major monument to even be vaguely remembered after 100 years. You're right. Yeah. Well, thank you.
All right,
this is a
for
tough
the call.
Problem.
We'll continue here. Maybe just real quick, I should reintroduce our guest. We're a little bit past the midpoint of the program. We're talking with Dr. Arjun Makhijani. He is president and senior engineer at the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research. They're based in Tacoma Park, Maryland. And we're talking about the efforts to set up a storage site for high-level radioactive waste, the site that has been selected, and a lot of money has been spent on characterizing and developing the site, is in Yucca Mountain in Nevada. Although, as you have heard, there are some scientists who still have questions about whether or not that is a suitable site, and indeed all the way along here, since Yucca Mountain was selected as the main site by Congress and the Department of Energy, folks there in Nevada have done everything they could to battle it. And continue to do that. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. Champaign County is next, line one. Hello.
Hi. Let's see, I've got a myriad of things. I wanted to get to weapons issues, too, since you suggested that would be something that you could speak on. But since you just mentioned the Science Academy, can you comment on the change of the standard and outline how that happened? I think what the enabling legislation
does.
Why don't I just put out three topics here, and then I'll kind of hang on and,
sure.
and go about my business, and maybe you'll get back to me, maybe you won't. So
sure.
The science standard, one thing, I think you're being a little too gentle with the corporations, as if they're a victim of governments. It's not just because I've seen the film recently, but they're always lobbying very hard, and I believe one of their Edison Electric or one of their lobbying bodies, informational unit or whatever, was very much in going for Yucca Mountain. So
yes.
They're not simply an innocent bystander of government regulation gone awry. I mean, they were wanting something to be done, and now they're suing the government for not providing it. On the weapons issue. Since we just had this revelation of South Korea using laser separation of fissionable materials, in today's press, I was wondering if you could speak on that a little bit, and then just speak sort of, if you have time, just generally on the issue of, the different kinds of reactors, the kind of material that's easy to separate, the kind of, the fact that if you're going to use a non-pressurized water reactor, you have to have, fields and fields of centrifuge farms, basically, to do this kind of obnoxious separation, something that can't be done on the sly. And I'm wondering whether the laser separation is actually different in that one can do it in a, less visible sort of way for, as far as inspection and energy use and that sort of thing. So if you could get to those three things and... I'll probably not speak again because you do a great job. Thank you.
And we only have 20 minutes.
Yeah. Military-related questions,
yes.
Do go and reactor types and so on. Do go to our website. There's quite a lot of material there at IEER.org. Not all you won't find answers to all your questions, but you'll find many of them. We also have numbers of publications that you can download free. There are numbers of books and so on. As regards separation of uranium, laser separation, I haven't seen today's press about South Korea, but there are, various levels of detectability, and laser separation might be less detectable than other ones. But people are going to pursue weapons and power technology so long as it's the currency of power, and it's going to be, you can't control the technology. We have to actually arrive at an agreement about the politics. That's my opinion anyway. Now, as regards the National Academy standard, recently there was this court ruling that David, you mentioned in passing.
Mm-hmm.
This arose out of Yucca Mountain's failure to meet the standards that were already in place of the EPA. In 1989, the Environmental Protection Agency published a standard for high-level waste repositories, and that included limitations on emissions of radioactive materials. One of them is carbon-14. Now, carbon-14 becomes a gas. It becomes like radioactive carbon dioxide that gets into all the food and everything if it gets out. Now, Yucca Mountain is porous rock, and so the fear was that this carbon-14 would diffuse out of the rock. And I was actually on the EPA committee that evaluated this problem in the 1990s. And we arrived at a consensus report, industry people, government people, environmental scientists, that Yucca Mountain may not meet this standard, but there were other repositories that, that probably could. And instead of, at that time, abandoning Yucca Mountain, the government decided, Congress decided to change the rules, passed legislation, and said that EPA should write new standards on the advice of the National Academy of Sciences. So the National Academy issued a report, which was quite a mixed bag. It had some good things in it, but it also had procedures that were very big loopholes for very lax repository standards. And it published the report in 1995. And in that report, the National Academy recommended, as it had before, that the limitation of radiation dose to the public should be at the time when the highest radiation dose is expected to occur in the future. Now, for Yucca Mountain, that is calculated to be several hundred thousand years into the future. But the EPA decided to ignore that advice, even though it was mandated by law to consider it very carefully. It dealt with it in a very lackadaisical fashion and rejected it. And so what the courts have said essentially is that the EPA wrongly rejected the National Academy's advice, and it should have set a standard that protected the public much farther than 10,000 years for which the EPA standard is valid. And so now we're back to square one for the third time in relation to standards for repositories, because Yucca Mountain cannot meet this test. There are repository locations that might, but the Department of Energy's own calculations show that if you go out a few hundred thousand years, the doses would greatly exceed the maximum allowable.
After the court made this decision, on the one hand, the folks in Nevada lost their argument that the process was unconstitutional. But on the other, the court said to the government, said, "No, you're not abiding by the standards that you yourself had set, or the recommendations that were made by this group of scientists that you put together to make the recommendations."
And right, this isn't the DOE's problem. Now, you know, this is a problem created by the Environmental Protection Agency. Hmm. Many of us, you know, the Environmental Protection Agency does many good things, but in this instance, many of us had urged the EPA not to ignore the advice of the National Academy on this count, because it was scientifically, environmentally, and legally correct to actually agree with the National Academy, but the EPA did not. It was for bureaucratic reasons, because previously they had said 10,000 years. They said this time also we're going to be bureaucratically consistent and correct and wrong in every other way. Well, now essentially they've been told they were wrong by the courts and Congress or the executive or the EPA, somehow they're going to have to deal with it. Hmm. And no one knows what's going to happen.
Well, that's what I'm wondering about, because it seems that the folks in Nevada who were opposed to the Yucca Mountain being the site, including the state's two senators, in some of the stories that I've read about this, when this ruling came down in July, both of them were quoted essentially as saying that this means they have won and Yucca Mountain is dead. Is it, do you think that that's actually true?
It may be. You know, the only way that this can be resolved is if Congress takes it up and essentially legislates a new standard that will essentially be a mandate for putting waste in Yucca Mountain. Because Yucca Mountain has so many defects and problems, basically that's what Congress is going to have to do if they want Yucca Mountain. So it's going to be very difficult to do that because Nevada has become much more politically important. I don't believe that this issue is going to be taken up before the election for that very reason. And after the election, well, it depends partly on the outcome of the election, but partly I think it won't, because now the difficulties of actually legislating a new standard and relaxing radiation protection rules effectively will be much greater than previously, when they had said, well, it's a very, very good site, it's in a desert and water won't get polluted and don't worry. Whereas now we know that the Department of Energy's own calculations show that in the future, when the peak doses occur, they are much larger than allowable. Hmm. So it's not a very good site.
Let's talk with another listener, and this person is in Chicago on line 3. Hello.
Yeah, hi. I want to throw something into the pot, which is related to what you've been talking about, but it's a different way of looking at things, at least the way I see it. This is what I'm talking about is a program that I viewed about 4 or 5 years ago during the Clinton administration over the PBS television station here in Chicago, WTTW. It was a program run by Bill Curtis, whose name you may or may not be familiar with. He used to run the 10 o'clock news program on CBS here in Chicago for about 20 years, and then he went to New York and ran their morning program for a couple of years. And since then, he's been producing shows mainly on science for television on his own. Anyhow, he produced this program, and it involved the history of atomic energy. And for the last part of his program, he dealt with a project that was being conducted at Argonne National Laboratory, in which they claimed to be developing a system for utilizing all the spent fuel and all of the ore already mined above ground and processed and possibly processed, and this to be, and they claim to have developed a program to produce electrical energy.
Right.
And they claim the claim was made that there was enough material already above ground that they could use that would last about 200 or 300 years.
I'm quite familiar with this.
I haven't heard anything since then.
Well, it's the Integral Fast Reactor Program. This was a research program that was active in the early 90s, and the reactor itself was canceled in 1994, although it still has lots of fans, as you point out, inside and outside Argonne. And the Argonne National Lab is still trying to revive the program, or some parts of it anyway. And unfortunately, in my opinion, whenever you're trying to separate these wastes and put them in reactors as fuel, you've got a couple of different problems. One is the separation itself is essentially a proliferation-prone technology. Earlier, the caller asked about, you know, can you detect people making nuclear weapons usable materials? Well, the separation technology that goes with the integral fast reactor is called electrometallurgical processing. It's a kind of electrolysis, and it's much more difficult to detect than the current plutonium separation technology. Now, the U.S. wouldn't be using that technology to make bombs because the U.S. already has lots of plutonium, but the U.S. can't keep a lock on these technologies. And once they're developed for commercial purposes, of course, everybody wants them, and then they can get diverted for weapons purposes. The second problem is that the 94% of spent fuel is U-238, uranium-238. And just the existing spent fuel, the U-238 in it, would take 2,000 reactors to consume it. And eventually you still have long-lived fission products like technetium, iodine-129 that you can't get rid of. So you need a deep geologic repository anyway. And finally, the amount of money involved in such a program is so, the liabilities. The problem is that the technological fans, and I'm an engineer, believe me, I looked for years. I could not accept that something I don't really like, which is a repository, that I would advocate it. I did not for 10 years. I looked at all. The reason I know in so much detail what immediately when you asked me is I've looked at all of this stuff, and it's just got so many terrible liabilities. You can work out the physics of it, but you can't work out the engineering, the economics, the proliferation, the cost, and the pollution. It's just not possible.
Yeah, Cole, go ahead. Go ahead.
The claim was made that the process that they used would essentially dissipate much of the radioactivity material so that it would result in no threat to the populace, for one thing, and also that the cost would be such that it would be at least the equal of present power costs, and probably less.
You heard about too cheap to meter?
I know.
You're paying for these things in Illinois, right?
Huh?
You can take my word for it by going to our website and look at some of the studies we've done on this. I'm not just saying it. Or you can also refer to the National Academy evaluation of this. This was a very big deal in the 1990s. And because promoters are always so enthusiastic, the National Academy, which is not known as a bastion of anti-nuclear advocacy, actually convened a panel on what's called transmutation to look at this nuclear waste problem. And they were actually extremely skeptical about it. And that's, I think, the best spin that I could put on their report. I have their report. It's a very huge, fat report. We've summarized it as factually as possible, and you're going to actually find the summary even on our website. So take a look. I think this is not an easy question to dispense with, and we all would like there to be a technological answer to the most difficult problems, and sometimes there are, and sometimes there aren't. I just don't know of a technological answer to this problem, or I would be the first in line advocating.
So just in a sense, I guess we've already answered this question, but there are continually, when I read articles on the subject, there are people who make the suggestion that at some point in the future, we might figure out some way to take this highly radioactive material and render it safe by some sort of technology that we perhaps don't have now, but that they say that they think it could be amenable to some kind of technological fix. And it sounds as if you're saying, given the present state of our knowledge and the technical problems and the economic realities, that such a technological fix is not very likely.
Yeah, no, it's given the present state of knowledge, it doesn't seem to be in the cards. Of course, we don't know what the future science will hold. Only a fool would say that. But given what we know, it appears extremely unlikely. See, the problem isn't in the physics. We know enough physics to say, yeah, physics principles say you can neutralize this stuff. So the problem isn't in the physics. It's actually realizing the physics into something that will work from a proliferation engineering cost and environmental point of view. Mm. And even if you leave cost aside and say, I'm willing to spend all the money I have to deal with this problem, you still can't actually marry the other desirables because you're creating very large proliferation risks and environmental problems. And in the end, you're still going to need a deep geologic repository. You don't get rid of that problem at all. You can't get rid of it.
Let's talk with another caller, and this person is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Could you tell me just a little bit about what the European nations are doing in this facing this problem?
Yeah, actually, they're all around the world, people are all looking at repositories. The United States has a small program on transmutation, what the gentleman was just talking about, a bigger program on transmutation along the same lines, looking at reactors and so on, is being explored in France, which is also the center of world plutonium separation, and in Japan. But for the most part, the center of addressing the spent fuel problem and high-level waste problem throughout the world is repositories. In France, they are investigating a site in the east. In Sweden, they are. In Belgium, and Switzerland, and Germany, and so on. So India, Russia, some countries have a problem because they may be small countries and don't have a site, and there have been some discussions of international repositories. But generally, I think the best repository program from an engineering and environmental point of view has been conducted in Sweden.
We are going to have to stop there because we have come to the end of the time. For people who are interested in finding out more about our guest organization, they do indeed have the website, and it's a pretty easy address. They can be found at www.ieer.org. This is the Institute for Energy and Environmental Research based in Tacoma Park, Maryland. Our guest, Arjun Makhijani, he's president, senior engineer. And Arjun, thanks very much again for giving us some of your time.
Thank you so much, David.
Our program here, Focus 580, is made possible in part by Strawberry Fields on West Springfield Avenue in downtown Urbana. Strawberry Fields provides a wide assortment of natural foods, vitamins, bulk herbs, fresh breads, and produce. The Strawberry Fields Cafe, looking out on Springfield Avenue, features expanded seating for the deli and the coffee bar. The broadcast is also made possible by a grant from Horeen's Pianos Plus, your Steinway piano showroom in Bloomington. Horeen's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos. Coming up a little bit later today here on AM 580 on the Afternoon Magazine, some conversation about the speech of our presidents. When you listen to a president address the nation, do you hope to hear some plain talk or soaring oratory? Should it be dignified or should it be down to earth? That question led Alan Metcalf to look into the speaking styles of all of their presidents, from George Washington to George W. Bush, and he's authored a book that's titled Presidential Voices. He'll be talking about that with Celeste Quinn following the 1 o'clock news. The show itself, that is the Afternoon Magazine, gets underway at noon here on AM 580 with the usual mix of news and weather and sports and other things, and we'll bring you up to date on what is happening with the weather at 12:35, and then, of course, in the 1 o'clock hour, there'll be this conversation and your opportunity to call in with questions, comments. Coming up in the next part of this show, we'll be talking about alternative medicine. We know that there are many, many Americans who are interested in alternative medicine as an adjunct, perhaps, to conventional medicine. We'll be talking with Dr. Patrick Massey. He's medical director for complementary and alternative medicine at the Alexian Brothers Hospital Network. That's in the Chicago area. That'll be up in the next part of the show. First, though, we'll take a break. We'll have news, and before that, an update on the commodity markets.
Agricultural information is made possible in part by a grant from the Archer Daniels Midland Company. ADM, the nature of what's to come.
And I'm Jay Pierce with this update on the markets at 10:59. Good morning. Well, easing weather concerns, the forecasters taking the frost in the upper Midwest out of their forecast.